Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Sports. My name is Keith Rathbone. I'm coming to you from Macquarie University. I'm here with Daniel Reiche, who's the author of Success and Failure of Countries at the Olympic Games, which is published by Routledge. And thank you for joining us, Daniel.
Yeah, thank you for inviting me to your lovely program, Keith.
I want to start out by telling you I really enjoyed reading this book. It's so punchy. It summarizes so much of, I think, the kind of questions a lot of our listeners have about the Olympics and why we see countries investing in programs, sports that maybe don't seem to make sense for us. But before we start to talk in depth about your book, I wanted to know a little bit more about you, how you got into studying sports, and how you came up with this project in particular.
Yes. I think there are two main reasons. One of them is that I grew up in Germany, in West Germany, and sporting competition between East and West Germany was always a big issue. And actually, since I grew up in West Germany, I have to admit that the East Germans outperformed us West Germans at the Olympic Games. In football, it was different, but maybe we talk about it at a later point. Secondly, I've been all my life a big supporter of my local football club, Hannover 96. And after I completed all my degrees and had been a visiting assistant professor at Georgetown University in Washington, D.C., and returned back to my birth and home city, Hannover, I decided to write a popular book on Hannover 96. This was in 2007, and it was published in 2008. It was great. The club also promoted it. There was a press conference with the club president and the player legion and a former mayor of the city. And I enjoyed the entire process of this book, which was not academic, so much that I decided I would like to also include sports into my academic life.
And so you decided to start with the Olympics. How did you get from Hannover 96 to studying the Olympics? Because I think most people would say there's a big jump between the kind of local club close-in work, and then when they read this book, they'll think, wow, the scope of this book is just immense.
Yeah, but so. I started working on a sport academically in 2008, and the book came out in 2016. So there was a process in between. So what I did at the beginning, I started to design a class on sports policy and politics, which I started to teach. And I worked on first publications, academic journal articles. And the very first one I wrote was on the role of politics in Lebanese sports, because in 2008, I started to work as an assistant professor for comparative politics at the American University of Beirut in Lebanon. I started in fall 2008. And I noticed that when I visited stadiums or arenas in Lebanon, that there was like politics was very visible. Like there were like posters of politicians in the arena. or teams would play in, their shirts would have the color of certain parties which were supporting them. So it was obvious that in Lebanon, sports and politics are not as separated spheres. So this is how it all started. And I published different topics in the field of sport policy and politics, and ultimately then the book on success and failure of countries at the Olympic Games.
In some ways, when I was reading the book, I felt like it was at times kind of a white paper. Like, I want to take your book and I want to send it to the U.S. Olympic Committee. I mean, I'm a bit of a USA homer when it comes to the Olympics, guilty. But is that who you were writing for? Who do you see the audience of for the book? Because I think there may be a lot of different audiences for it. And one audience must be the organizers of the national committees.
Yes, I think, first of all, it's an academic book, and it's for scholars being interested in sporting success. But I think, yes, the book is also interesting for policymakers, for, you know, people who work in ministries of sport or in national Olympic committees, in national, international federations, and who want to know the factors that led to sporting success of leading countries.
So the beginning of the book starts out with that question of what does it mean to be successful at the games? And I think that there's a kind of interesting through line in your book, and at times it comes out, but it especially comes out in your conclusion, and I hope we can talk about this as we discuss this today, which is that success means different things for a lot of people. So how did you define success in the book? What are most Olympic committees around the world looking for? How do they define success? And is there any kind of problems with how they define it?
Yeah, I mean, short answer, it's all about medals. But if we look more into details, there are different type of medal rankings. So, for example, in the U.S., it's more popular to look at the total number of medals won, while in most other parts of the world, rankings are published in the media that would look at gold medals first. So if one country wins one gold medal, but zero bronze and silver medal, and another country wins zero gold medal, but many silver and bronze medals, the country with the one gold medal would be still ranked better than the other country. So this gold medals first approach is the most common medal ranking in the world. The New York Times has introduced a point system where it would give more points to a gold than to a silver and bronze medal. That's also interesting. Some colleagues have introduced rankings that would publish medals per capita or medals by GDP. And so there are a number of suggestions for alternative medal rankings. For example, my colleague Nadim Nassif from Notre Dame University has introduced a world elite sport ranking where he takes into consideration the popularity of sports, which I think is a very innovative approach, because we rank a medal in a sport that are only practiced by a few thousand people in the world the same as a medal in a team sport that is played by millions of people. And this is kind of weird.
It's very weird, but sometimes it's kind of fun too. I always joke with friends that in a team sport, everybody on the team should get their own gold medal. So, you know, basketball should be 18 gold medals. but
so, this is a good point, Keith, because at the Olympic Games, we have cases that an individual athlete like Michael Phelps can win up to 8 medals in one single Olympic Games. And then we have an entire soccer team which can only win one medal. So there's an imbalance.
It's true. So the predominant way, though, of assessing Olympic success, it seems to be, and you make a very persuasive case in your book that many Olympic committees consider this the most common way is just medals, and especially gold medals.
Yes.
Right. And that leads them to kind of set targets for themselves, because if they're going to invest money, they're going to want to see certain targets. Is this a common feature within the games? Are a lot of Olympic committees setting targets?
Yes.
How are different countries defining their success?
I mean, most developed countries would define aims such as we want to end up in the top 3, in the top 5, in the top 10 of the medal ranking. Very few countries have aims that are broader, such as maybe winning specific medals. Like Brazil said before the 2016 Summer Olympic Games, we want to win the gold medal in soccer because that's our national sport. As a German, I'm hesitant to mention that they succeeded to do so by winning the final against Germany. And some other countries, like Kenya, for example, they win most of their medals in running. They said we want to be more successful in other sports as well. So few countries do this, but most countries just look at their rank in the medal ranking or the total number of medals won. Although there should be other aims, such as being represented by a similar number of men and women, being represented in a certain number of sports, being successful not only in one or two sports, but these goals are not common. Most countries focus on very few sports.
I did think it was very interesting when reading your third chapter on how national Olympic committees and nations themselves define their sports targets, to think about the difference between the sports superpowers and what we might think of as the sports minnows, where some countries are defining their goals as just being represented in more sports. Let's try to compete more broadly. We shouldn't just be here to wave a flag at the opening ceremony. I want to see our athletes. And then, of course, other countries, the United States, China, Russia, consider themselves to be sports superpowers and almost think they should be competing in every sport. And then, of course, there's, as you say, some countries that take certain sports to be their domains. The Australians, of course, I work down here in Australia, so are much in love with their swimming. And when they don't do well in the pool, that's a national catastrophe.
Yes.
So it was interesting thinking about all this in your work, because even though they might have these different goals, we still see a lot of investment, right? And so then in your next chapter, you start to address the question of why countries even compete. And are they competing for the same reasons? Why do countries compete in the Olympics in the first place?
Yes. So, I mean, a weakness of the academic literature, but also on like media reporting on the matter, is that they focus on those countries that win medals. But these countries are the minority. For example, at the 2016 Summer Olympic Games, there were 205 national Olympic committees participating, but only 86 of them were able to win a medal, which is 42%. So 58% of participating national Olympic committees did not win a medal. We have even worse data for the Winter Olympics. We had in 2018 in Pyeongchang, 92 national Olympic committees participating. Only 30 of them, which is 33%, were able to win a medal. So I think, and this is what I also tried to do in the book, to be more inclusive and look also at those countries that do not win medals. Because most studies, they would look at best practice cases. They would look at the country where you are living, Keith, at Australia. They would look at Norway. They would look at UK and US, but other countries such as Lebanon, for example, where I live and work, are mainly ignored in the academic literature. So it's also interesting to look at the motives of these countries. And I think there is like a, you know, a two-way directional process. Like from the point of view of countries such as Lebanon, they want to participate in the Olympic Games as a sign of statehood, like having a national anthem, like having an own currency. They want to raise their flag at the Olympic Games. And from the perspective of the organizing committee, from the International Olympic Committee, they want to give their events a label that it's global, that all are included. So they put a lot of effort into including countries such as Lebanon by inviting also athletes that have not qualified to the Olympics to make it a universal global event.
So it seems to me, and I wanted to commend you in your work for consistently in every chapter kind of pressing on this desire to win medals and actually kind of critiquing it, even as you're explaining how you do it, always saying, maybe we should reconsider whether this is the way we think about Olympic success. But if you want to succeed, here's how you can do it.
Of course, Keith, I think we are all shaped by our environment. So, of course, since I work in a developing country, it was very important to me to also include the perspective from countries such as Lebanon, but at the same time not losing the focus and answer the question, what does it need to be successful in the Olympics?
Yeah, I thought that was an excellent through line throughout the book. And this emphasis that you have in the fourth chapter, which I thought was one of the most interesting chapters in the book in some ways, in the ways in which nationalism, sovereignty, are working and how they work through different sports and how they work in single ethnic versus multi-ethnic states and how that helps to shape what success can even mean for these countries, I think is really interesting. An interesting forward in some ways to discussions later in your work, how you actually go about winning medals, because the beginning of your book sets the question, what does success even mean? And then the latter half of your book, I think, effectively illustrates, okay, if we agree success means medals, which you don't necessarily even seem to agree with at a lot of times, here's how you might go about it. So I was really fascinated by that chapter in particular. But the majority of your book, in some ways, is an explanation of how to go about winning medals. What are the best ways to be successful? If we accept the premise that winning medals is what we want to do, how do we do it? And the first few chapters of that part of the book, you're taking on the literature on the field and kind of explaining it or taking it apart. So the first argument that a lot of people make, and I've made this argument myself, so maybe I'm guilty in some ways, is that, you know, winning medals is just all about who has the money to pay for training, right? It's just a quick GDP to medal conversion. That's, I think many people think that, but you take on that idea and explain the complexities of it. So is it just money equals medals? Is that how we should think about things?
Yeah, I mean, it's part of the explanation. But to have a general introduction to the answer of this question, research has changed, and we have kind of two generations of researchers on sporting success. And the first generation did mainly look at general characteristics, at macro variables such as GDP, population size, geography. Now we have, and I'm part of a second generation of researchers on sporting success, which looks more to the policy level. This does not mean that it's totally wrong to look at the macro variables and to look at the wealth of a country, for example. Or population size or geography. But overall, these factors just matter for specific sports. But if we look at the entire Olympic Games, we cannot explain success and failure without including the policy perspective. So, for example, if we look at sailing yes, all the countries who are successful in sailing, they have access to the sea, so geography, and they have money, so wealth. So yes, this is a sport where we can explain success with wealth and with geography, although we still need to explain why some wealthy countries with access to the sea are successful and others who have the same characteristics are not. Then we have sports where wealth doesn't matter at all. For example, in running. Running is a sport for everybody. So we have East African countries succeeding in running. And we have then equestrian, for example, where, again, wealth is very important. And then we have team sports such as soccer, where the Brazilians are doing a pretty good job, for example. So we need to look, we need to see at it sport by sport. But overall, the policy level has become more important to explain success and failure of countries than the general characteristics.
Well, I would, before we jump into the policy level, I would like to ask a couple more of the kind of macro factor levels. One yes. thing that I had heard before, and I think you do a good job of delving into, and it riffs off a person who I spoke to in this program a few months ago, is the role of ideology. What role does ideology play, and how are you defining this? What role does ideology play in the success or failure of countries at the games?
It played a major role until the Cold War ended in 1990. East Germany only participated between 1968 and 1988 in 6 summer and 5 winter Olympic games, and it's still in the top 10 of the all-time Olympic medal ranking with a population of only 60 million people. So the East Germans were the first that introduced policies that would first been criticized by the West, but later adopted by them. So in 1968, at the Winter Olympics, the East German ice hockey team became last in the Olympic competition. And the East German government said it's useless to invest in a sport where we cannot win a medal, like ice hockey, as it should rather compete in individual events. So they reduced the East German Ice Hockey League to only 2 clubs after the 1968 Olympics. So until the end of the GDR, the East German Ice Hockey Championship was just played between 2 clubs. And no other clubs got funding anymore. So because the government wanted to, its athletes to compete in individual sports. So, and East Germany classified sports into 2 groups, and those sports that deserve funding because they are likely to achieve success on the international level, and into sports that do not deserve funding because they are not likely to have success at the international level, like ice hockey or on individual sports, table tennis. Germany is today doing very well in table tennis, but there's still a West-East gap because this is a legacy of the GDR, because in the GDR there were no investments into table tennis infrastructure. So the East Germans were the first, and other Eastern Bloc countries also adopted this approach. And today all countries are doing it, that they differentiate between more medal promising sports and those that are not likely to deliver gold, silver, or bronze.
So I think it's fair to say the major punch of your book is the latter chapters, where you delve into the policy level. And I'd like to spend the majority of our time talking about this. You come up with your own formula, as you call it, the WISE formula. What's the WISE formula?
Yeah, the WISE formula is addressing the policy level. And the 4 letters stand for the promotion of women's sport, the institutionalization of the support of Olympic sports, then the strategic specialization of medal promising sports, and the ability to early adopt new trends in elite sport policies and be a pioneer in promoting sports newly added to the Olympic program.
So I thought we just, is there a preferred order you'd like to talk about them, or just talk about them in the order of whys? I would guess you put them in that order because it whys. It just sounds like a good acronym.
Yes, just, but that's true. And I was, after I came up with this, I was nervous whether anybody else came up with an acronym in academia, but I didn't find anything on the web. So I was thinking it sounds nice.
Yeah, I think, I mean, it's wisdom. You're handing out wisdom here to the Olympic committees.
But I think, of course, the specialization on medal promising sports is maybe the key. Without specializing on medal promising sports, it seems to be impossible to be successful in the Olympic Games.
So explain a little bit, and actually maybe this is a good segue anyway, since we were just talking about the DDR, but explain a little bit what specialization means and why countries should, how they can do it and why they should do it.
Yeah, I mean, so if we look at the Olympic medal ranking, and apart from the United States of America, which is doing very well in many sports, I think there's just one sport where they didn't win a gold medal, which is biathlon. But most other sports win most of their medals in just very few sports. Most sports are dominated by few countries. So although the Olympic Games seem to be a global universal event, at the end, it's the games of the few in many sports. For example, if we look into the case of luge, this is a sport dominated by my home country, Germany, which won, German athletes won more than half of all luge medals in the history of the Winter Games. Don't think this is a popular sport in Germany. There are around 6,000 athletes in 100 clubs. So this is even a niche sport in Germany, and there are not many tracks globally. So, and there are many sports which are dominated by one or two countries. And when a country enters the Olympic arena, I mean, there are two ways of dominating a sport. One is that there is like an historic path that the country has been always successful in that sport, like Germany in luge. Or when a sport is relatively new to the Olympic program, then of course the country can put resources into the promotion of the sport to become a superpower in that sport. And there are two examples which show very well how countries can make the strategic choice of investing into a sport. One is women weightlifting, which became in 2000 an Olympic sport when the Olympic Games were hosted by Sydney in Australia. And China strategically invested into women weightlifting, starts women of early age to be, which have favorable physical characteristics, starts to promote them, puts them in specific schools where they are trained all day. And so China became the dominant woman weightlifting country. And we see the same with South Korea, which dominates the short track competition, the Olympics. It has been very smart not to put much resources into speed skating, because this is, there's an historic dominance by the Netherlands, and it's very difficult to break into this. So they started to strategically focus on short track, which is an Olympic sport since 1992, I believe. And this sport is dominated by South Korea. So we have either historic explanations, or we have strategic recent choices by countries when sports were added to the Olympic programs. Is in all the cases no coincidence the result of policies when we look at the dominance of countries in these sports.
And you even make the point that countries can't just rest on their laurels. I mean, maybe they have a historic relevance, but they still need to be engaging in performance-based funding models, right? That
yes.
It's not enough just to invest the first time. You have to make sure that that you're in continually investing in things that have success. So what's performance-based funding and how, where did this come from?
Yeah, that's a good point, Keith. I mean, most countries have over time developed policies that would give more resources to sports that deliver medals than to other sports. And what makes this controversial is that this approach does not take into consideration the popularity of the sport, how many people do such a sport in a country. I mean, I just mentioned that there are only around 6,000 people being in luge clubs in Germany. There are more than 500,000 table tennis players, for example, in Germany, or 700,000 handball players. So one could argue that these sports deserve much more funding because they are much more popular. And the UK has a very radical no-compromise approach. So those sports that don't promise medals like basketball don't get a funding for elite sport, although they are very popular in the population. So here we see that there are strategic decisions by policymakers and which sports get funding and which not.
And it seems like for most countries, this is just an absolute essential. The United States might continue. It seemed like the United States kept coming up as an outlier again and again. But countries like India, which doesn't specialize in Olympic sports, but maybe specialize in other sports, or Sweden, a country that had a kind of, as you explained it, a more egalitarian model, they're just falling by the wayside, even though yes. India, population-wise, should be more successful. Or Sweden, they have such a high GDP, but per capita, but they are completely falling behind their peers, right?
Yes, that's true. Sweden is a very good example, but also Finland. So they have been very successful in the Olympic Games in the first part of the 20th century, but then they missed to follow the trend of specialization in medal promising sports. They have more egalitarian approaches in society. They want to treat sports equally, which, I mean, there are good arguments to do so. But now, if it comes to elite sports success, they are now behind other countries.
Yeah, I also, one of the things I found interesting in this chapter in particular on specialization was that it's an essential strategy. If you want to be successful at the Olympics, you need to specialize. You have limited resources, but it's also risky, right? Because the IOC can go ahead and get rid of sports that they don't want to have as part of their program at the Olympics. And if you've specialized in them, either as a strategic move or because of some historical linkages, all of a sudden they're gone. Maybe you don't have much of an Olympic capacity anymore, like Iran with wrestling.
Yeah, that's an excellent argument. I mean, if countries are too narrow, if they just focus on one or two sports, they are very vulnerable if these sports are expelled from the Olympic Games. I mean, there are some sports like field hockey or handball where I would not bet on their Olympic future because they are failing to globalize. You know, handball, I'm myself a big handball fan, is a beautiful sport, but it's mainly a European sport. And just recently at the Handball World Cup, we had again the last four teams in the tournament were all from Europe. And in field hockey, although it's globally a little bit more spread than handball, with countries such as India doing well, it's also failing to become popular. Rugby sevens was admitted to the Olympic program starting in 2016. So there is nothing stable. There's always a fluctuation of like sports being expelled and others added to the program. So if countries are too narrow, it might hurt them in the long term.
That brings up your E in some ways, this early learning, because as we see this fluctuation, that provides opportunities for countries, right? How can countries take advantage of early learning to advance their metal objectives?
Yeah, I mean, smart countries would like immediately start promoting sport after it was admitted to the Olympic program. We have seen that rugby sevens has been added to the PE curriculum in some countries, and I gave the example of women weightlifting in China, where China dominates the competitions. So yes, countries need to be very, very quick, and when sports are newly added to the Olympic programs, because usually this happens just a couple of years before the games. So, and of course, those countries where these sports were already popular have an advantage. But if one acts quick, one has an advantage compared with other countries that are slower in their decision-making processes.
It was funny. I was reading your book, watching. There's a big rugby sevens tournament going on here in Sydney right now. I just ended today, actually, although I don't know who won, so I won't spoil it for anyone. But I was watching the women's rugby sevens, and Russia was competing, and I was so surprised. I was like, I didn't know they played much rugby in Russia, let alone women's rugby. And then I read in your book that Russia was trying to early adopt rugby sevens in order to be more successful, and they seemed quite competitive, I must admit.
You know, Keith, it's really funny when the Soviets hosted the Moscow Olympics in 1980, which unfortunately was boycotted by the United States and some other countries. It was the only time that the Soviets won a field hockey medal. This was a sport not popular, but since they knew they would host the game, they put for a certain period of time a lot of resources into field hockey, and they showed how well they are able to properly plan success. But unfortunately, it lasted not long, so they never won again a field hockey medal. And now it's the same happening with rugby sevens, which became part of a PE curriculum in Russia. So Russia is still benefiting from the tradition of planning from Soviet times. And they're still doing very well in sports, although some medals were won by doping, as we know now.
I was going to ask about that later, but since you bring it up, I wanted to ask you about doping and what role you see doping is playing. You don't have doping as one of your chapters, but certainly the DDR is one of your key examples of a state that practices specialization, institutionalization, early learning, but also doping. So what role does doping play in winning medals? And if you can get away with it, should that be a part of people's strategy? I mean, we can't suggest that, but I'm thinking in my head, what role is that playing?
Well, at the last Olympics, I remember one German daily newspaper that I like to read. They published every day the medal ranking, and below the medal ranking they wrote, "We cannot guarantee this ranking until 10 years from now, because this is a period of time that medals can be stripped away." And I mean, this is what is happening now. We have now all the time in the news that the rankings from London 2012 are still changed because of doping. So, of course, this is for researchers a disaster when we want to look at reliable data, and then this is changing. So yes, but doping shows. As you rightfully say, it's not a major topic in my book, but of course it needs to be discussed in the context of sporting success, because here we can see how far some countries go to achieve success. And today we know that there was a very strategic state doping in the GDR, There are state-recognized doping victims which get now a state pension because they have so severe physical damages from the doping that they get a state pension now in Germany. And so this is sad, you know. And there is a story of the Montreal Summer Olympic Games when the East German swimming coach was asked, why do your female swimmers have so deep voices? And he said, they are not here for singing, they are here for swimming. That's sad.
Yeah. I mean, but that's the extreme case of institutionalization, right? But that doesn't, yes. That isn't, when you are arguing, your eye is institutionalization. When you argue for institutionalization, I don't think that's what you mean. What do you mean when you say countries should institutionalize?
Yeah. That's a great point. I mean, at the end, you are right. It's an extreme, approach of institutionalization to have like a top-down doping processes. And it seems that many athletes, young athletes in the GDR didn't even know that they, what they would do. Because it was like a centralized approach where like at practice sessions, all athletes would have to take certain things. But no, when I talk about institutionalization, I have more in mind institutions such as the Australian Institute of Sport or Olympiatoppen in Norway, which strategically organize the elite sport sector, develop policies on basically anything, practice, coaching, training, competitions, domestically and internationally. And yeah, countries that have institutions that plan the elite sport sector usually do much better than countries that do not have such institutions.
Yeah, it almost seems like a truism, but when you think about it, this isn't really the image we have of sport, right? We think of it as these great athletes driven by their own passion who compete. That's the story that we get. Or maybe, well, you're not watching NBC, but that's the story of the Olympic Games. And we don't often think about the ways in which the national committees themselves make very strategic decisions about how they're going to invest their money, how they're going to institutionalize training. And I hadn't really understood this myself as a scholar until I spent a lot of time doing research at the ANSEP in France. And you see the cafeteria that all the elite athletes are eating in. You see them at training sessions all day, and they're just living there on this campus practically.
Yes.
And you think, oh, okay, wait a minute. You know, this is what elite sport outside of professional sport really looks like in a lot of places, but not every place. Are there some countries that haven't institutionalized, and as a consequence, they are seeing a lack of success?
Yes, I mean, one outlier is the US, but they are not in terms of failure. I mean, they, different to other countries, they don't have a ministry for sports, they don't have a national sport institution, they have given all the power to the National Olympic Committee, which is enjoying privileges such as that they don't have, that they are not taxed. And most of the promotion of elite sport is happening in schools and universities in the United States. So the U.S. is different from the rest of the world, and which, by the way, is also interesting. Why they are widely ignored in many academic studies, because scholars like to compare similar cases,
right?
So the U.S. is quite different. But then, of course, we have. I was talking about the 58% of countries that did not win a medal at the last Summer Olympic Games, at the 66% of countries that did not win a medal at the last Winter Olympics. So yes, many countries fail to implement policies such as focusing on specific sports, such as having a centralized institution that is managing the sports sector. And those countries are not competitive with the Australias, Norways, UKs, Germanys, Japans, and Chinas.
Yeah, the United States, since you bring it up, does stick out as an outlier. And I think for our non-American listeners, or people who haven't lived in the United States, it would be interesting maybe if you take a minute or two to explain, is the United States a model that just nobody else can copy? Is it just so unique or strange? Is it a factor of having such a higher GDP and a big population? This long historical tradition of school sports, what is it that makes the United States successful in the Olympic Games that maybe other country that allows it to not follow this wise formula, maybe?
I think this needs to be explained in the context of the Cold War. So the United States wanted to prove that it's different than the East European countries where there is heavy state involvement into the sports sector. So they did not introduce a national institution for the promotion of sport. They did not dedicate a government department for the promotion of sport. This does not mean that the state is absent in the United States. It's just more hidden. We have in many states in the U.S., a best paid public employer is a sport coach at a college. Mm-hmm. And public colleges have very advanced sporting infrastructure. And as I said before, the National Olympic Committee of the United States does not have to tax the sponsorship money it receives. So the U.S. Olympic Committee is acting a little bit like governments or national sport institutions are doing in other countries by making decisions such as how to distribute its revenue. And this is also based on success. So it's not that in the U.S. All the sports get similar funding. It's following the global pattern of giving priority to those sports who promise more success than others. So, for example, swimming would receive much more money than table tennis.
Yeah, I did my undergraduate work at Ohio State. So now when I teach my students about sports history, I give them a little mini lecture on college sports in the United States. And Australian students are typically surprised to know that Ohio State has a stadium that seats 105,000 people.
Yeah,
it is a very unusual situation. One other thing that the United States has done, though, that I think explains some of its success is your W, right? So what is the role of investing in women's sports? And is this maybe the most important of your things for countries that want to see more success now?
Yes, I think the U.S. has always been very good in promoting women's sports. But we can also see that China, who made the strategic decision in the 1980s to open up to the world and related to sports to become a global sports superpower, which they managed to do so. And one major explanation is that a majority of medals China has won is in women's sports. So China was very clever. And if we see the region where I'm living and working, the Middle East, Lebanon is doing relatively well in promoting women, but other countries in the region don't do. And Iran, for example, just won the first woman medal at the last Olympic Games. It had won before in the history of the Olympic Games 60 medals, but all by men. So imagine if they would have promoted women like they promoted men. They would not have only won 60 medals. They might have won 120 or 130 medals. So they would have a completely different rank in the all-time medal ranking. We have a country such as Saudi Arabia or Qatar, which sent women for the very first time to the Olympic Games in 2012 in London. Imagine Qatar is participating in the Summer Olympic Games since 1984. Not before 2012, they would send women. So, and the future of the Olympic Games, I'm convinced there will be much more mixed gender competition. So countries that do not promote women, they will further fall behind in success.
Yeah, it seems to me, given that many countries don't invest well, if at all, in women's sports, given that many women's sports are not available all the way all around the world because of these geographic conditions, because of ideological or cultural conditions, if a country wants to be successful in the games or achieve more success, maybe investing in women is the way to go about it. Certainly
it's more rational because, overall, there are many sports where the female version is less popular than the men version. So, so economists might argue it's more cost efficient to invest into women than men sports because success might be achieved easier in many sports where you have lower participation rates in women's sports than in men's sports.
Yeah, not to mention that it's probably just the right thing to do.
Yes, of course, yeah. Of course. And I always say,
yeah, as you emphasize that.
Located in the Middle East, I'm emphasizing this in the book, as you know, yeah. Keith, and I'm always saying to everybody, sport is a human right and nobody should be excluded from it.
So I had a couple of questions I wanted to ask to see how they affect some of the conclusions that you draw here. And then I want to talk to you about what you're currently working on. But one of the things that I was reading, thinking about when I was reading this book is this idea of sports superpowered-dom. And I was also thinking about how this might be affected in some ways, some strong ways, by individual athletes. You mentioned Michael Phelps already in the interview, and I was thinking about Michael Phelps. And America's won so many swimming medals in the past four games, summer games, but Michael Phelps has been so instrumental in each of those medals, it seems like, at least on the men's side. How important in some areas, whether it's sprinting, Usain Bolt, Michael Phelps in the pool, are these kind of super athletes? Do they change the numbers in some way?
Yeah, we have sports where athletes can compete in more than one competition at the games. And if you have a super athlete, he can deliver up to 8 medals, as an extreme case with Michael Phelps, for a country in a competition. We have cases of cross-country athletes from Norway, which also won like numerous medals for their country. So it's rational for countries to, if you have a gifted athlete, to in individual competitions where participation in several events is possible, it's rational from a government point of view to invest into these athletes.
The other thing I was thinking of that I wondered if it on a macro level was playing a factor is longevity in the games. It seems like countries that have competed for longer have done more to shape the games in the way that suits them. When we look at the Winter Olympics, for example, most of the countries in the whole world don't compete in any of those sports, but yet yeah. They all count the same as a medal in track and field, for example. So I wondered if longevity wasn't a factor, that the games are still in some ways very Eurocentric.
They are, particularly the Winter Olympics. Now in Pyeongchang we had 92 countries participating, but one third of them was just sending one or two athletes, and these athletes are often diaspora athletes, so they might represent Nigeria, for example, but have never lived there. So yes, and three quarter of the medals at Winter Olympics are won by European countries, and the others are like United States, Canada, China, Japan, South Korea. So yes, the Winter Olympics are quite Eurocentric.
So is there a possibility for de-Eurocentricizing the games? Can we make the games more global, or is the colonial past just made that impossible because European games are global games now?
Yeah, I mean, there is. I mean, there are two ways. One is, of course, countries can do what I described in the book as a pattern in sport policies around the world. They can specialize on something. And I mean, the Netherlands, which are good in speed skating, show that even if you don't have mountains in the country, you can even win a medal in the Winter Olympics if you like strategically focus on specific sports and build an infrastructure for them. But also, one should question in general, like, which sports are admitted to the Olympic program. For example, I hardly understand why a sport like chess is not admitted to the Olympic program. It could become of the Winter Olympics, for example, and it's much more globally spread than a sport such as luge, which is, as I said, practiced by 6,000 people in the country that dominates Germany. So yes, there should be also a critical discussion on which sports are admitted, and it seems this is mainly for the pleasure of like the most advanced countries in the world. It's not rational. I mean, as a German, I'm happy about every luge medal my country wins, but the truth is nobody cares about luge in the world, so it should be not part of the Olympic program. Other sports such as chess much more deserve to become part of the Olympic program, and then we might have, although men's chess is currently dominated by a Norwegian, we might have and somebody from India, for example, who wins a medal in chess.
As a former competitive chess player, I have to agree with you. And I do. I would point out just a small note that chess was on the program of the Barcelona People's Olympiad. If it had gone forward, they would have had chess as one of their sports. So, Daniel, can you tell us what you're currently working on? So after everybody finishes reading Success and Failure, they can look forward to the next project.
Yes, so I became very much interested in sport and nationalism and citizenship issues. I wrote two papers and have almost finished a third one. The first paper was specifically dealing with Lebanese Rugby League national men's team, which qualified for the last World Cup, even made it to the quarterfinal. And it was mainly comprised of Australians, mm-hmm. of Lebanese heritage. So I was interested in athletes with dual nationality who make strategic choices of which country they represent. And this is just one out of many examples we had at the FIFA World Cup. We had an Algerian team, which was mainly comprised of French players with Algerian heritage. Then a second topic I became interested in was naturalizations in sport. And I just published with my Turkish colleague, Shem Tinas, a paper on naturalizations in a comparative analysis of Qatar and Turkey. And now I'm working on a paper on the eligibility criteria in both codes of rugby league and rugby union. One of the few sports that allows non-nationals to be in a national team. So one can play for Germany, for example, in the German rugby team without German citizenship if one can prove residence over a certain number of years or heritage, like German parents or grandparents. So this I find quite interesting and maybe also a model for other sports to follow. And yeah, so I want to continue working on like issues in the field of sport, nationality, citizenship in the years to come.
Well, thank you very much, Daniel, for joining us. I've been speaking with Daniel Reiche, the author of Success and Failure of Countries at the Olympic Games, which was published by Routledge Press, and professor at American University of Beirut, Thank you so much for joining me today, Daniel.
Thank you, Keith.
And thank you all for listening. This has been New Books in Sports.